Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm delighted to be talking to Patricia Banks about Black Culture, Inc., how ethnic community support pays for corporate America. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And I'm delighted that you're back, actually. So a couple of years ago, we talked about one of your books that was about primarily museums, but also touched on things like corporate funding, philanthropy. And I guess Black Culture Inc. kind of moves that agenda on quite significantly, but also picks up on some of the themes that you've written about before. And I'm really interested in, I guess, kind of why you wrote this book and where it fits in with these broader themes about things like corporate sponsorship, culture, race in America, cultural taste, those kinds of themes.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned my book, Diversity and Philanthropy at African American Museums, that we talked about a couple years ago. And you're correct that Black Culture Inc. really grows out of that study and builds on it. So that's a study where I travel across the United States and talk to over 100 supporters of African American museums to try to get a sense of why they were supporting these institutions. And of course, I would also visit the museums on those visits. And so you can imagine, I would go to the museums and I would look through them. And one of the things that was really striking was seeing all of the evidence of corporate support. So you see the donor walls with big corporate names, and you see exhibition booklets with corporate logos. And so I really became curious about trying to understand, why are corporations supporting Black culture? And what I found was an answer that not only helps us understand that particular question, but it also delves into broader issues such as why corporations are more broadly involved in what I call ethnic community support or philanthropy and sponsorships related to racial and ethnic minorities. And then these even bigger questions that are related to race and capitalism and corporate social responsibility and stakeholder capitalism. But essentially, you know, the thesis of the book, what I argue is, I argue that one of the reasons that corporations are supporting Black culture is that for them, it's a form of diversity capital. And what I mean by diversity capital are cultural practices that allow firms to leverage opportunities and address social problems that are related to race and ethnicity and other types of social difference. And so what you essentially find is that corporations get a return on their gifts. So the gifts are certainly enriching cultural institutions, Black cultural institutions and initiatives, but corporations are also getting this return. And the return that they give is one that's related to their racial image. It's a practice through which they project an image, they construct this image that they value race and ethnicity, they value inclusion, and they value African Americans.
I mean, I was really struck by a couple of things you said there. The first thing was that experience of going into these places, not just museums, actually, but in the book, you think about things like music festivals and kind of broader cultural events. And the book really brings to life the experience of once you start spotting who is paying for some of these spaces and who is in control of some of these spaces, it does prompt the questions of what exactly do they get in return. But at the same time, I was really struck by the book's, maybe I'd call it kind of ambivalence in the analysis. You know, it's not a book that says all forms of corporate patronage are kind of evil, or, you know, organizations are like selling out or whatever. It tries to kind of, I suppose, show, as you just mentioned there, the various different ways that, on the one hand, organizations get things out of it. On the other hand, corporations, you know, can profit and like literally profit in some ways. But also audiences really, really matter here. And over the course of our chat, we'll unpack that. And I guess the place to start is quite early on in the book, where you talk about the Smithsonian and the various kind of museums that make up the Smithsonian, and how there are really clearly different interests that different corporate sponsors have, some of which seem quite logical. So, you know, aerospace engineering and space exploration exhibitions, but then some of which maybe reflect a bit more of that kind of cynicism, and maybe some of that kind of art washing. So what's the story of the Smithsonian and your kind of experience of thinking about corporate sponsorship in those institutions?
Yeah, so I think it's really, really interesting. So I thank you for mentioning that the Black Culture Inc. it addresses museums like the Smithsonian, but I also went out and went to music festivals, and there's also some historical research as well. So for this chapter, the first chapter after the introduction looks at the Smithsonian Institution, and I look at the Smithsonian Institution through the lens of corporate sponsorship. So the Smithsonian is, of course, the nation's leading cultural institution. It's very important for learning about the history of the United States, for housing the nation's what's considered the best kind of cultural artifacts and art. But there are different museums. So there is the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture. There's the National Museum of the American Indian. There's a history museum. There's an art museum. And what I show is how each of these museums plays a different role for image construction for corporations. Another way to put it is they all play a different role in the impression management of corporations. And so we see, and I can just offer some interesting examples. One of the, I think, the most striking examples for the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and how they use the giving at this institution to construct their racial identity, connection to Black people, and authenticity for products is through an example of 21st Century Fox. So 21st Century Fox was a donor to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. They gave a $2 million gift to the museum. And so typically what happens when corporations give is they not only do they give the money, but then they write about it in various communication channels. So they'll write about it in blog posts, they'll write about it in press releases. Because again, part of what's going on here is there is a desire for stakeholders to know about this gift. So they write about it. So what's really fascinating with the 21st Century Fox gift to the National Museum of African American History and Culture is that they announce the gift on their blog, and they write about the gift. You know, we recently gave $2 million. But then when you read further, what's really fascinating about it is they, after kind of talking about the gift, they then begin to discuss two movies that they have recently put out. And one film is Hidden Figures. And then the other film is a film about Nat Turner, which is Birth of a Nation. So Hidden Figures is this film that's about African-American women mathematicians who worked at NASA. And then Birth of a Nation is a fictionalized drama about Nat Turner, who was an enslaved man who led a rebellion in the 1800s. And so the donation announcement then becomes this vehicle through which they promote the films. So they mention the films, they have a link to the film websites in the post. And then with the film about Nat Turner, Birth of a Nation, they go even further. There is a link to Nat Turner's Bible, which is in the collection of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So basically what happens is, you know, what better way to promote these films that are based on Black history than to link them to the National Museum of African American History and Culture? And the announcement of the $2 million gift becomes a vehicle to do so. So I think that's one of the most interesting examples. A related example with the National Museum of the American Indian is Orion Pictures. So Orion Pictures was promoting a film in the 1990s, Dances with Wolves. Some of you may remember that film. And so just like 21st Century Fox used their a patronage at the National Museum of African American History and Culture to promote the film, we saw the same dynamic with Orion Pictures and the National Museum of the American Indian. So again, the giving, the museums benefit, and then museums certainly are wonderful museums that need the resources. But what happens then is these companies get to promote their products. Along those lines, an interesting example in the book that I talk about with the National Museum of American History is with Ralph Lauren. So the fashion brand Ralph Lauren. So Ralph Lauren, as you know, is a company that's associated with American preppy chic. That's kind of the brand image. And so at one point in time, an artifact in the National Museum of American History, the Star Spangled Banner, needed to be refurbished. So this is the flag that actually inspired the national anthem in the United States. And so Ralph Lauren gave a $10 million donation. And again, you know, this piece of cultural history, it needs to be preserved. So that was a very worthy cause. But Ralph Lauren benefited through using it to brand and continues to this day to do that. So what's really interesting is the company has products that have an image of the American flag on it. And one is this product that's called the Iconic American Flag Sweater. So it's just a plain sweater with this simple image of the American flag. And if you go to the website and you purchase that product, what you'll see when you look at the description is not only information about the materials, but what you also see is a mention of the fact that the company helped to support the preservation of this flag. So again, you have this cultural institution that's benefiting, but then you also see these companies benefiting by using it to construct a particular type of image. And so each of the Smithsonian museums then plays a different role depending on the particular type of image that a company is trying to signal.
This sort of corporate signaling, I suppose, in the examples you've just given, is, I guess, what we call a kind of an exchange. I think your analysis is kind of critical throughout the book. But in the middle of the book, you take a much more maybe kind of capital C critical look at practices that are not really these kind of maybe cross promotions or exchanges, but are much more to do with salvaging the reputation of, in one case, a company that had a kind of reputation for racism, I guess. But in another case, actually, you know, it was used to sell tobacco products, really. And I was fascinated by the two examples, one from Denny's, one from a jazz festival, of both, I suppose, the kind of, you know, very cynical use of sponsorship to effectively kind of transform a reputation, but also more crucially, the way that audiences, media, advertisers had kind of co-produced, perhaps, or, you know, were certainly kind of heavily involved in producing this reputational cleansing. So I wonder if you could maybe give a quick summary of those two examples and where this, I guess, more kind of sinister or at least, you know, the kind of uses we should be much more skeptical of come in.
Thank you. Yeah. So these are both fascinating examples. And I think you're right. So part of what we have to think about, and we can talk about this a little bit more later, but are there any costs to this? Or is it just a win-win? Do the cultural institutions win and the companies win? That's the question you have to ask. And I think you're right. There are these parts in the book where it becomes very clear that there can be some costs to this. There can be some costs. And so the chapter on the Cool Jazz Festival is one where that is very clear. So just to give a little background on the Cool Jazz Festival. So the Cool Jazz Festival was one of the biggest Black music festivals that took place in the United States in the 1970s and 1980s. And it was sponsored by a big tobacco company, Brown and Williamson. Brown and Williamson, the American side of it, over the years, different parts have been sold off to different brands, but it used to be a standalone entity that was one of the biggest tobacco companies in the United States. And so to understand why Brown and Williamson was involved in the Cool Jazz Festival, one of the things we have to consider is we have to consider the racial and ethnic segmentation of the tobacco market. And one of the important kind of dimensions of that is the fact that when we look at Black smokers and we look at white smokers, just to take two groups, the products that they are more likely to smoke when it comes to cigarettes are different. So even to this day, when we look at menthol cigarettes, and there's a type of cigarette that's flavored with mint, we have about close to 90% of African Americans preferring menthol cigarettes, as opposed to around 30% of white Americans. So there's this segmentation in the market. And while tobacco companies dispute this, there are some health practitioners who argue that that menthol cigarettes are particularly damaging to health. So that's important to consider as well. So then the question is, why is it the case that you have this segmentation in the market and so many African-American smokers preferring menthol cigarettes? Well, it gets back to the promotion of these products to them. And as I show in Black Culture Inc., part of that promotion to them is through the Cool Jazz Festival. So the company sponsors this big festival, and they use the sponsorship as a medium to communicate to the African American community that they are good for the community, that they value the music in the community. And what happens is, of course, this messaging is not communicated just to the Black community directly. It is also communicated through to the Black community through an intermediary, which is the African American media. And so what happens is Brown and Williamson has this messaging related to the festival, and they cultivate the Black press. And so what happens is, we, within the pages of Black newspapers, we not only see paid advertisements that are communicating this message that, you know, the Brown and Williamson is good for the Black community, look at what they're doing, they're sponsoring this big festival, but we also see the same messaging in the editorial pages of the newspaper. And so the Black media then becomes part of this story where we're seeing this message that this tobacco company is good for the community being projected to African Americans. And I think what's really important to point out is that by the 1970s and 1980s, there was very clear evidence that cigarettes were harmful to health. Very clear evidence. And in fact, by that time, it was the case that cigarettes did need to be labeled with a warning. So the product of cigarettes and the Brown and Williamson brand really had a spoiled identity, right? There's the product is spoiled. The brand has the spoiled identity. On the very products, they're required to have this warning that they're not good. But what happens then is that the festival then becomes this vehicle to cultivate this message that the company cares about Black people, and the company is good. And so in that sense, that really presents another side to what we're seeing with Black community support being used as a form of diversity capital. What we're having is the ethnic community support certainly provide support. In this case, that was helpful to Black musicians, because I should note the Cool Jazz Festival, it was a festival for jazz musicians, but over time kind of evolved to also have other forms of Black music like rhythm and blues. And so it was certainly a vehicle through which those artists were able to, get paid, which is, of course, very important. But there was this side where the festival is also being used to promote what we call vice product, for those who look at consumption from a sociological view, vice products. It was used to promote a vice product, a product that was harmful to health. So that's a real cost. That's a real cost. And I can also talk about Denny's a little bit too.
Well, I was going to say actually that you've touched on a couple of things with the Cool Jazz Festival and cigarette and tobacco advertising that come to the fore slightly later on in the book with, I mean, it's two case studies really, but you talk quite a lot about McDonald's in the book. And I was fascinated by the idea that if the Cool Jazz Festival was about essentially kind of selling cigarette products, then there's a point where McDonald's is cultural sponsorships aren't just about selling McDonald's, but actually end up kind of making McDonald's a sort of religious, Christian, almost kind of sacred brand. So I'm fascinated to hear a bit more, I guess, of how a corporation goes beyond just, you know, changing its kind of reputation with a particular segment of society, in this case African Americans, goes beyond selling products and ends up being a kind of sacred object.
Yeah, so the McDonald's case is absolutely fascinating. And I talk about McDonald's sponsorship of Black culture in a couple of the chapters. So one is a chapter on the Essence Festival. And then I also talk about their sponsorship of the Inspiration Celebration Gospel Tour. So this is a sponsorship that McDonald's has had for the past several years. And it's this case of what you could call gospel marketing, that they're not the only company to do this. And to understand this, part of what we have to think about is religiosity and race. And so if you compare, for example, African Americans to white Americans, African Americans do have higher levels of religiosity. And so what's happened is that marketers then have used Christianity, have used the church as this vehicle to try to reach Black consumers. And one way that they do that is through sponsoring music events that focus on gospel music. So McDonald's fits in with that tradition. But again, it's just really fascinating because just as, you know, by the 1970s and by the 1980s, when Brown and Williamson is trying to market their menthol cigarettes to Black consumers, at this point in time, there's clearly this spoiling of the product. And part of that comes from public health practitioners. And of course, the same thing at this point in time, it exists with McDonald's. So there's a whole narrative of the brand as being bad for health. Right. So it's fast food. It's not good for you. And African-Americans actually have higher levels of consumption of fast food than other groups. And so part of that narrative, too, is that it's particularly bad for African-Americans. So what's really fascinating about the gospel sponsorship, Inspiration Celebration Gospel Tour, is that the brand is able to counter this image as a spoiled brand, as selling these products that are bad for health. And they're able to project this image as being sacred. And at the same time, of course, appeal to the Black community. And again, this takes place through several mechanisms. The Inspiration Celebration Gospel Tour, it travels to different cities. Typically, those cities have fairly high populations of African Americans. And oftentimes, the concerts will take place in church. So it's this, I attended a couple different stops on the festival, and I write about it in the book. But so it's really fascinating. So you have this church, right? So it's this house of worship that represents Christianity. And then within the church, we have the McDonald's iconography. So we have the golden arches placed to different parts of the church. We have the, you know, word, the name of the company throughout the church. And so that process, along with others, is one of the ways that the company is able to project this image that it is connected and values the African American community, and also that it is sacred.
It's really crucial here, and you talk about actually how it gets incorporated into you know parts of the services and the sense actually that, you know, again, this isn't just a sort of corporate agenda that's pushed onto a passive audience, but actually, you know, audiences, consumers, you know, kind of heavily involved with these brands and are really active participants in the construction of these particular brand identities. And that's the kind of sort of conclusion and where the book's final example comes in. And I think you use the term kind of prosumption promotion practices, which struck me that kind of runs actually all the way through the book. You could read prosumption practices into how people consume things at museums as much as you can with music festivals. And obviously in the context of kind of music festivals, there's this question about kind of selling out and becoming too commercial. So I suppose the kind of final example is the story of Afropunk and the way that it's now got a series of quite cool, quite like I sound so old saying this, but kind of like cool and hip young brands associated with it. But at the same time, those brands have lots of questions about, you know, how they control people's data, or about, you know, their association with, you know, maybe kind of poor practices in the creative industries, you know, things like this. So what's the sort of Afropunk story, and how are consumers kind of bound up with doing prosumption of particular brands' identities?
Yeah, so again, Afropunk is such a fascinating case. And so when we talk about prosumption, what we mean is these actors who are not only producing goods, but they're also consuming goods. And so kind of the classic case for that is people on social media. So if you're on Instagram, you're on one hand, you're consuming the posts of others, but then you're also, you're creating product. You are creating, in this case, posts. And so what I do in the chapter on Afropunk is I look at prosumption through the lens of festival goers at the Afropunk event. So Afropunk is this very big music festival, and it started as a way for Black punk rock fans and musicians to come together, because they would often find themselves to be the only Black person in the venue when they were at traditional punk events. So this event starts as a way to bring everyone together. And so the first one takes place in Brooklyn, and they still have had it in Brooklyn since then, but it has expanded. So there's a concert series in Africa, Europe. There's also one in Atlanta, but the original one was in Brooklyn. And so what happens is at the festival, bands, Black punk bands will perform, as well as other bands that have people of African descent in them. So that's an important part of it. But another equally important part of this festival are the festival goers themselves, and the fashion, the presentation of self of these festival goers. And so they take great care. Many of the festival goers take great care in styling their hair and styling their outfits. And so this very distinct Afropunk look kind of emerges from this context. So there are Afrocentric elements, for example, with hairstyles, maybe braids or locks. That gets blended with traditional punk. So you might have in your braided style, maybe you'll have some neon pink, and then maybe you'll have some combat boots. So this new style is kind of developed. And so what happens then is that part of what companies are purchasing from their sponsorship is not only the opportunity to market to these attendees, right? And this is, there is a predominantly Black audience there. They're not only using this as an opportunity to market to them, but to use the festival goers as a mechanism to reach a bigger audience through social media posts. So one of the things that happens at Afropunk and also other festivals like Essence is that brands on the festival grounds will have these kind of tents. They'll have these little tents or booths. And in the booths, what they will have is they will give away free products. So oftentimes they create product that has a Black element to it. So they'll create particular products, merchandise, kind of free merch to hand out to festival goers. But they'll also have photo booths. They'll have these photo booths, these elaborately designed photo booths. And so they will encourage festival goers to take photos in those photo booths, and then to post them on their social media channels with these corporate hashtags. And what's really interesting is that in some cases, in one case, there was one company at Afropunk, so you would go to take your photo, and then when you would step out of the photo booth, they would ask, have you posted to your social media using this hashtag? And then if you said yes, then they would hand you some free product. So that was interesting. So again, there's another exchange going on there. But essentially then what they get is when these festival goers are posting, the brand then gets associated with Blackness, with edginess, with hipness. And so these festival goers are getting a photo in a interesting, kind of visually stimulating backdrop. And then what companies get for that is companies get to brand themselves, to associate themselves with Blackness and edginess. And I think what's interesting is we certainly see companies doing that with rap and hip hop. So that's, you know, you look at companies like Sprite, for example. We look at companies like Nike, and they have kind of drawn on the symbols of Blacks and hip hops to kind of give them this edgy urban image. And so what's interesting when we think about Afropunk is we have companies using the style of the festival goers there to communicate Black and edgy kind of image. But of course, it's a different different one than hip hop communicates.
I mean, there's loads more we can talk about, actually. And, you know, you mentioned that there's loads more examples in the book. Actually, there's analysis of a whole range of different corporate actors as well as different cultural festivals and historical analysis. And obviously, I urge people to read the book, partially because, and this comes right the way kind of through at the very end of the book, I think the analysis is really not just to do with the Black community in America, contemporary African-American culture, but actually has a series of insights that can be applied pretty kind of smoothly and straightforwardly far beyond that particular cultural context. I think of a range of different examples in the European and in the Australian settings where some of the kind of lessons from the book are really clear and apply really really well. And it strikes me that the book has kind of set a research agenda almost, and the place to kind of wrap up our discussion is whether future work that you're going to be doing is going to be in kind of, you know, within that sort of research agenda. Are you thinking about applying these lessons and these insights in future books beyond the case studies that you've got, or are you thinking about doing something kind of completely different, having sort of set the terms of a possible new research direction with Black Culture Inc?
You know, all of my research has led me to the next project. So of course that is the case here. And I think, as I was saying in the beginning, you know, on one hand, it's a story about corporations and their support of Black culture, but there is a much bigger story here. And I really see this as providing important insight about a big question that, I think people in the corporate world, people in nonprofits, and the broader public is interested in, which is, what are the benefits and what are the limits of corporations being involved in social initiatives, cultural and otherwise? We're really seeing just growing emphasis on, you know, corporate social responsibility, a kind of term now that's being used is stakeholder capitalism. So this idea that corporations are not only responsible for increasing shareholder wealth, but also being concerned with the well-being of other stakeholders, such as local communities, consumers, suppliers, and workers. And we're seeing this concept just being increasingly embraced, and CEOs saying profit and purpose are compatible. We can do both. And I think that what Black Culture Inc. allows us to do is to look at, well, what happens when corporations are involved in social initiatives? Is it the case that it is simply a win-win? Because this is how it's often being presented. And I think what my book shows, I think what Black Culture Inc. shows, is that sometimes it can be a win-win, but at other times there are costs. And so that is a topic that I'm continuing to explore in my research. The last chapter in the book begins with the Black Lives Matters uprisings in 2020 and corporate donations to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So this is a moment where we see companies giving to the museum and using it as a way to signal, we are concerned about racial inequality. And so in my work moving forward, I'm looking at corporate support of more generally. And I'm looking at this question of are profit and purpose compatible? If so, under what conditions? And if not, what are the conditions? So yes, I'm continuing to explore these issues in my ongoing research.
And a future book?
We will see. We will see. There's been a pattern with me. So I don't know. If it fits the pattern, that will be another book.